cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 238th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 237 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. And look under the radio show tab. In addition to my previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, www.johnmack13.com. Next Sunday, July 15th, my guest will be author Giselle Hausman. I hope that you'll be with us then and every Sunday for this year's season. Before going any further, a few announcements. I was the featured speaker on Saturday, June 23rd, at an Iona College conference on international business, economics, education, and environment, in which I spoke about personal artificial intelligence in the home and office and demonstrated on an Amazon Echo. I'm in the process of revising the PowerPoint to support the presentation so that it'll be more robust for those who did not get to the presentation but asked for material. If any listener wishes a copy, please email me at johnmack13@gmail.com and ask for one. The John C. Hart Library in Sherbrooke, New York, will host a special Meet the Authors event at 1 p.m. On Saturday, June 21st. Local authors in Upper Westchester, Putnam area will discuss their work, and books will be available for purchase and signing. It's an event that should be interesting, and I hope we get a good attendance. Now to this week's show, the 238th in the series, as I mentioned. My guest is writer and poet Vincent Bell. And I had a page below then, just before Vincent's name. I first met Vincent at an open mic session at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers' Center in Sleepy Hollow, New York, in January of this year. He then came into the Poets at the Old Putt Night at the Freight House Cafe in Mayapack on February 21st, when I was the featured poet. At the conclusion of my reading, Vincent participated in an open mic session that followed, and when that night became the basis for the book Live at the Freight House, published in April on Amazon, Vincent's poems became part of the anthology. He then participated in celebration of the book's publication on this show on May 20th, and tonight he is the sole guest on the show. The listeners wishing to join Vincent and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. 69756. I generally hold called participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. But let's get started. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
How about starting us off with the poem?
Sure. This poem is called A Runway Too Short. Finally, I was able to say that I wanted to be a poet, even though I understood that I would be trying to take off on a short runway. The nightmare started immediately, accelerating down the runway, but never fast enough to get airborne, while seeing its end through the cockpit window. I was a donkey with blinders, just walking ahead. There wasn't time to learn new skills, only enough time to improve what I already knew.
And that's how you started off. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up, as oddly as it may seem, in Manhattan, on the Upper East Side, what used to be known as Yorkville. And I went to Catholic school and then public school. My family, the Bell family, had lived in New York City for three or four generations. And before that, they were farmers in upstate New York.
My father grew up in the first elevated apartment house in Yorkville on 96th Street. He was a contemporary there of young Bob Wagner, who became mayor of the city. Bob's father, as you probably know, was a senator from New York. And I grew up at the very northern tip of Manhattan Island, the Inwood section, where it was known for both having Columbia University's the football stadium, Baker Field, the only forest in New York City, the Inwood Hill Park, and more bars at that time than any neighborhood in New York. By a lot, so we both grew up in New York. Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
Surviving, I guess. I grew up when I was first in Catholic school. It was not that long after the end of World War II, and it was a very German neighborhood, so there was a lot of ethnic tension in the schools and in the playgrounds where we played. And my life was further complicated by the fact that my older brother became a priest and was ordained at the local church. So even though my baptized name was Vincent, in school I was known as Father John's younger brother.
Because
I was far from being saintly.
Was he the parish priest, or was he in an order?
He was in an order. It was actually an order from France. He went to the seminary in Canada and then spent 20 years in Africa.
Wow. And did he remain in the priesthood?
No, he left the priesthood to get married, as many men did at that point in life. And then he got a job working for the government and was posted to all sorts of weird countries like Thailand right after the end of the Vietnam War, and Pakistan during the Soviet invasion. And he had a rather checkered life.
That's another parallel. My brother was a Christian brother of what was then called the Christian Brothers of Ireland for 25 years. He was considerably older than I was, as your brother probably was, who was the priest. Mm-hmm. He taught me and Iona College. I had him for two semesters. I got two ways, and he threw me out of class once. Then he became the principal of a Palm Memorial during the Kareem El-Jabbar, the Lua Cinder days. Then he also left the order after 25 years. He was married. He was a deacon in the Patterson Diocese, and he taught at Caldwell College in New Jersey. So there's another similarity.
It's very similar. It's a remarkable story.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in a private school in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. It was called Walden, and it's longer available. It was a very progressive school. I specialized between elementary school and high school in getting thrown out of school. I'm actually proud that I was actually thrown out of public school.
I believe that's a school that a friend of mine later became the principal of, a fellow named Tony O'Keefe, and then he got out of that business, and he was selling home energy systems in Putnam County. He was the first person that we know of that got the perfect 1600 on the college boards and a scholarship to Columbia.
I started writing when I was in high school. I basically was writing poetry just for myself then and not sharing it with other people. But what was interesting is when I graduated from high school, I applied to two colleges, neither of whom wanted me. One was Harvard and the other was Bard. And then I told my parents that I was, wasn't going to go to college. I was just going to be a writer. And the next day I got my draft notice in the mail. This was 1964 and Vietnam was really humming. So I was able to get into NYU then and got a student deferment and got my undergraduate and first graduate degree from NYU.
Did you, you said you wrote poetry for yourself. Did you write for a school paper or for the literary magazine while you were in high school?
Yeah, both. There was a school paper and a literary magazine, and I wanted to be a writer. I thought it was a very romantic thing, and I wrote. I continued to write poetry while I was in college. And when I got out of college, I worked in a bookstore because I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. And I eventually ended up working in book retailing and publishing. And I continued to write. And I started telling myself almost on a daily basis, Vincent, when you retire, you're going to write full time. And I kept pushing that off and got married, had kids, bought a house, moved to Westchester. And what's really ironic about the whole thing is that when I did retire, which was about 6 years ago, I did start writing full time and I'm actually getting some traction now. So I'm really thrilled about it.
Now, I know that in college and for your first degree, that you, both of them, you're an English and a humanities major. Mm-hmm. What had you planned to do with that, and what got you into going for the next advanced degree?
I was going to be a teacher, and part of that was driven by a junior high school teacher. Part of that was driven by the fact that it was a draft deferment. And when they came out with the lottery, my number was kind of mediocre. And I got at NYU, they offered me a government fellowship for graduate school. So I had free tuition and a miserly stipend each month. So I got a master's degree at NYU. And, life kind of flowed by.
You mentioned you went into the bookstore and to book retailing. Did you continue in the book business for your business career?
Partially. I started working at the local alternate bookstore at NYU, which was called the Student Book Exchange, which was, interestingly
right.
enough, started by a guy named Lenny Riggio, who eventually bought the Barnes & Noble name in a bankruptcy. And I continued working for him for probably about 10 years at Barnes & Noble. And I was one of the senior buyers for the chain. And then I worked for B. Dalton Booksellers out of Minneapolis for a bunch of years. And then I ended up working at Simon & Schuster, a publisher.
And Barnes & Noble, of course, then bought B. Dalton. I was I used to go down to the only Barnes & Noble store on 18th Street when they used to buy and sell textbooks. They had other mm-hmm. books, but it was mainly known for textbooks. That at a bookstore that was in the train station by Fordham University uptown called Lamb's. They were the two places that people took books to sell and to buy.
Yeah.
And I was amazed when all of a sudden Barnes & Noble became the ubiquitous bookstore, eventually pushing out the Daltons and the Waldens and the other ones, and now obviously threatened by Amazon. How did you make the transition?
They're being Amazon big time now.
Yeah. How did you make the transition from the retail and the buying end to the publishing company?
What I always specialized in when I worked in book retailing was remainders and sale books. So I was the person that went out from the bookstore chain to publishers and bid on their remainder lots that they couldn't sell. And I ended up working for a division of Simon & Schuster, which was their promotional remainder book division. And I was the vice president for purchasing there for a bunch of years.
Now, along the way, you also picked up another master's in business. When did that come along?
That was after I left publishing. I was working in an architectural firm and a law firm as the administrative financial person in the partnership. And I got an MBA from Fordham then. And that turned out to be a great career, and I ended up working for a large international law firm for 13 years before I retired.
Which one was that?
Aiken Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld.
Okay,
one of the
largest
lobbying firms in the United States.
Yeah, I had some experience doing with when I was an officer of control there with Cat Walder, who was our law firm, and I was mm-hmm. I also followed fairly closely Finley Kimball because Bob Wagner went to work there, and the only time I ever spoke to him was I called him there. My son had met him. I called him there in the office, and I was very surprised when Finley Kimball just fell apart. I mean, that was a boutique law firm with some big names, Hugh Carey and Wagner and
well,
a lot of other people.
We called it Finley Crumbles.
Yeah, I can see that. We mentioned Amazon briefly. Where do you see, obviously, Amazon's more than the bookseller now, and I've mm-hmm. I followed them through the Kindle and through the AI stuff. Where do you see that book industry going?
It's a really interesting paradox because the book industry had the last rights several times over the last 10 or 20 years, and it always seems to find a way to survive. I mean, the latest data I have is that hardcover book sales are up. Small independent bookstores are doing really well, and big chains that are not particularly quick to react in the marketplace, such as Barnes & Noble, are not doing that well. I think that there are a lot of people in this country that care about books, and they will find a way to purchase their books, whether it's in an independent bookstore or through Amazon. I buy a lot of my books from Amazon. I mean, I think ultimately people buy books in the way that is most convenient for them. And
I hang around in my local Barnes & Noble in Mohegan Lake, and or in the Cortland Town Center, it's now called. And I spend a lot of time there with some retirees from IBM and some other people, and if there's no one there, I write and I read, and I hang around in the coffee area with friends. And I find myself, although I hope they stay in business forever, and I do buy a bunch of the poetry books there, but I find myself, if it's an expensive book more than $15, checking the Amazon price and sitting in Barnes & Noble and ordering from Amazon, which may not be loyal, but it makes sense to me bang for the buck for my dollar, you know. So, but I feel kind
people
of disloyal.
People will ultimately make their purchasing decisions based upon what makes economic sense for them.
Yeah,
I mean, I
mentioned...
do most of my writing in the library, so I avoid that whole dysfunctional dichotomy. But, I mean, I use the library, too. I still use it a lot, and I wonder what's going to happen to libraries. I mean, they don't have very many books anymore. They mostly just have electronic things.
Yeah, I noticed that the Barnes & Nobles has shrunk the shelves, but they are doing very well in kids' games and in a lot of games, and also in the coffee area. So maybe there's and they're also starting to sell the accessories like batteries. They should be selling USB drives and other things, because there are so many people that right there who may want a USB drive, but they are moving in that direction.
They're having a lot of trouble financially. They just ousted, I think it's the fourth president or the second president in 4 years. I don't remember. But there's a lot of turmoil at the executive level because it's really a real estate company, not a bookstore chain anymore. And when their leases are up, they just seem to close the stores.
Yeah, they mentioned that one of the reasons that some people think the Cortlandt Town Center store is fairly safe is someone said they own the store. I don't know whether that's true or not. But if they did, they're a bit locked in. They came late to the electronic reader business, too. And the Nook was a nice device, and one of the interesting things on it is that they added to it the Google Play, so you could have, as I do, the Kindle app on my Nook. So it was a nice thing, but they came late to the game. So So Amazon been wiping them out.
I think they came too late today.
Yeah, I do too. You mentioned that when you started in the bookstore and in the retail business that you were writing and you had planned first to transition into full-time writing and then after you got married and everything, after you retired, did you write all that time and until you did get into it full-time? Were you writing along the way?
There certainly was never a period in my life when I wasn't writing, but the rate of writing has varied depending upon what was going on in my life. Now I'm writing probably 3 to 5 poems a week, so that's the highest rate I've ever had. When I was very active in the financial aspects of whatever business I was working in, I may have written a couple of poems a month, but I saved everything. I literally have hundreds and hundreds of poems that were written over the last 20 and 30 years. And one of my goals now, if I can ever find the time, is to go back and kind of harvest that material and see what I still think is worthwhile out of it and try and put it together into new types of poems.
Now, you and I have just discussed poetry, but along the way, did you write a fiction, nonfiction, anything of professionally relating to business?
I've not to date. I really haven't written any fiction that I wanted to save. I've written a couple of plays, and I've been to Ireland with my wife a couple of times, and I've written long, short stories about experiences in Ireland. But primarily, I've been a poet. But just in terms of pure writing, as a business person, I wrote report after report after report on various financial aspects of firms that I worked in. So it's probably not useful at this point, but it's certainly comes under the rubric of writing.
Gee, I was just the opposite, that I'd always wanted to, when I was very young, to be a writer. And then life, as it did with you, got in the way, and I wound up, through luck, getting into technology. But technology led me to writing for magazines and for some newspapers, and I wrote an awful lot. Unfortunately, my last paper that I was doing the column for went out of business after 225 columns. But I not only, even though I was an English major, I not only didn't write a poem, I didn't read any poetry for 35 years until a quirky situation in the local Barnes & Noble got me to pick up the book by Charles Bukowski, and I said, hey, this guy's crazy. If he can do it, so can I. And that got me mm-hmm. going there. So I, like you, came to it late as a business and more than just something I might be interested in. Did you publish anything along the way at all?
I had a lot of stuff published when I was in high school and the first couple of years in college. As I said before, I went to NYU, and it was in the 60s of the previous century. And I was going to school in the village, so I was very lucky because I got to hang out in coffee houses and St. Mark's in the Bowery Church. So I heard all of the beat writers reading there live and heard a lot of stuff that was that was quite revolutionary from a writing point of view. So I think, aside from being very lucky to have been able to be exposed to that, I think that helped me a lot with my writing. I was conflicted because, you know, I had been a student for so long and I was tired of being broke. So when opportunities became available to me to work in the business world and make what seemed like a ton of money then, that was more attractive than becoming a post-beatnik poet.
No, I understand that. My son is considerably younger than you, also went to NYU. He went to the Tisch School. He decided when he was in grammar school he was going to be a screenwriter. And he's working out in the West Coast as the TV writer and as a game developer now, doing scripting for electronic games. But he lived at NYU, and he was extremely happy there with the school. And so it was a very
you can't have a better environment than to go to school in Greenwich Village. I mean, you can learn
when he graduated,
get into a lot of trouble. It's a great place.
When he graduated from NYU, his graduation was in the park. Neil Diamond was the main speaker at his graduation and the singer. He had done 3 years at NYU, and then he had an opportunity to go on the road and it was goodbye to college. But his daughter graduated with my son, so he not only taught, he sang. So that was very interesting.
That's really cool.
How about another poem?
Sure. Let me see what I got here. Okay. This poem is called The Last Man. My uncle was gassed in World War I. He had lung problems and lost some teeth, but he recovered. When he was decommissioned, he and his friends in the unit each put a bottle of their favorite booze in a locked glass-paneled credenza in a Massachusetts hotel lobby. Each fall, their plan was to return to drink the bottles of the guys who had died since their last meeting. When there were only three bottles left, each one tried hard not to die. The last man returned to finish the bottles, leaving his alone on the shelf, waiting for a stranger to drink it.
And was the last man your uncle?
No.
So, do you know if the bottle ever went away?
Nope. Don't know any more than what I have in the poem. I have all sorts of fantasies about what happened, but I don't have any hard knowledge.
You said you move full time into poetry, and you do 3 to 3 to 5 poems a week, and and I know that you've had some published in addition to 4 poems in the anthology of from Live at the Freight House. Since you sent me that note, have you had many more published?
Well, I've had 5 published just recently in an electronic journal called Off Course from the University of Albany. And I have a poem that's going to be published in the Westchester Review in the fall. And
that's,
I have a lot of stuff out.
That's
I'm
a good
sorry,
publication.
Go yeah,
that's a good publication.
I was very pleased by
that's terrific.
And
so
I
how did you get,
just finished.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So you're up. Keep going.
I submit a lot of stuff. I mean, my wife has been incredibly helpful in terms of disciplining me because I love to write. I would just prefer to write all the time and not deal with all the administrative and non-writing stuff that's associated with sending out stuff for submission. But she tries to discipline me, so I have a lot of stuff out. And I just finished a chapbook manuscript, which is going through its last editorial review, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to get that placed by the end of the year. And then I have another chapbook right behind that that is probably 75% written. So I'm feeling pretty cool about the way things are going for me right now.
But the discipline, that's one of the things that the duotrope has brought to me. If I get rejected, I immediately go and I see who's a comparable subject person, and it goes right back out to a new person. You know, I think
mm-hmm.
that's been a tremendous help to me. And I check the weekly things for new publication because they're very often looking for things to start off, you know, to make a name. So I do that.
What you're saying is so important. You really have to focus on that stuff. I have about 60 submissions out right now, and it's a numbers game. If you have 60 out, you're probably going to get a couple accepted. If you have 20 out, you're probably not going to get anything accepted. It's like crap shooting.
Yeah, and an important thing for the listeners is to know who to send something to. You have to know what they publish. Very often you either have to read their book, you have to look at it online, you have to consult duotrope, you have to know what the submission policy is, you have to know to when they're reading.
Yeah, no, it's
they're
incredibly complicated. I mean, I use an editorial consultant, a third party whom I pay, and I send this person a bunch of poems, you know, every couple of months, and I get back from this person a list of what she thinks are the best journals for each of the poems to submit them to. She doesn't do
that
any work with my writing or anything like that. It's purely...
Has that been very helpful to you? It worked well?
Oh, absolutely. It's not cheap,
okay,
but it's so worth it. I mean, there are, I think, 3,500 journals now that are soliciting poetry in the United States. I mean, it's a Herculean task.
Yeah. And it's an interesting job, too. You don't find many people that are doing things like that.
That's
so
correct.
That's good.
I mean, I'm very lucky that I was introduced to her. She's been incredibly helpful. And I'm interested in doing anything I can that allows me to continue to get published, but at the same time frees me up as much as is humanly possible just to write. So I'm very lucky that way.
Well, speaking of your writing, how about one more poem?
Sure. I'm trying to find a poem that's not as depressing as the ones I've already read. I've been to Ireland a bunch of times, so let me read one poem about Ireland. It's called On the Way to Cork. riding backwards on an Irish train, I heard a chat about dementia led by a woman across the aisle whose auntie has it in the States. I hid from the talking and the old ladies with dark dresses. The Irish sky moves quickly, randomly exploding in primary colors. Below it, the passing villages have the same houses, lined up in shades of beige. Well-worn faces in various tones of crimson are mostly young and old. The others have gone for hope in other lands.
I like that too. Of course, I have an Irish background. I've never been there, but many of my friends have stories about being there in all different places. And I may have actually had something published there, but I forget. It could have been years ago.
John, my advice to you is tomorrow to book a flight and go. It's an extraordinary country.
We've already talked about
the Scotland, which in other ways I like as much as Ireland, but it is quite different.
Yeah, I know that. You know,
I would love to move to Ireland, but my wife doesn't want to leave her kids.
I can understand that. I don't want to leave my area right here, and the wild animals that I feed, and the. And my 250-year-old barn that I have that we live in, so I'm very happy where I am. I'm settled. We talked about the editorial consultant. We talked about the Do It Trump service. You might also, if you haven't looked at it, to look at poets and writers joining it. If you have published poems, you can be an accredited poet from poets and writers, and that looks good then when you're sending to other people, and I guess for bio, you know.
I didn't know
it's
about
poetsandwriters.org. Speaking of these helps and everything, how did you get involved with the Hudson Valley Writers Center?
When I was finally retiring, when I actually retired from my big boy job, I started a consulting business and did that for a bunch of years. And then, you know, one morning I woke up and said to my wife, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm tired of riding Metro North. And my wife was terrified that, you know, I would go berserk because I wasn't working anymore. So she gave me this long memo with all these suggestions she had of things that I could do. And one of the things was to start studying at the Hudson Valley Writers Center. And it was an absolutely incredibly valuable suggestion. I have one teacher there that I've been taking now for almost 2 years, and she's become an extremely valuable mentor to me. And I've learned a lot. It's really worth it.
Which one is that?
Her name is Jennifer Franklin. She teaches a poetry course that runs all year long.
She's also the director of the program now.
Yeah, she puts together all the readings and everything else.
The woman who's many of my friends have taken, who's been on my radio show, who's the friend who gets a terrific reputation. Have you ever done anything with Amy Holman?
Yes, I know her.
Yeah, I really like her,
she's actually my editorial consultant.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Amy's a good person.
She's unbelievably strong and valuable.
And she makes that trip from Brooklyn all the time to talk there. I've also had her at a
public transportation. It like takes her 2 days to get there.
Yeah. I had her a book signing thing that I put on at Coogan's restaurant in Upper Manhattan, and then she came, and then luckily there was another woman from the photographer from Brooklyn Heights, and they lived fairly close to each other, so they shared a cab home anyhow. You mentioned that it's been very helpful. exactly what way has derived center benefit, if you can qualify it or quantify it?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. The class, the number of students in the class varies as it flows through the year. The 12 months are divided into sections, and you register for each section that's coming up. And I always take it all the way through. But what the incredible value is the feedback, the workshopping feedback you get from the other students. When you come to class, you bring one or two poems, and you read your poem out loud, and you distribute copies to everyone in the class. And people really, in a positive way, dissect your writing and make suggestions on how you might consider doing one of the things you're trying to do differently. And that type of close reading and close analysis is so valuable. And I look back on what I wrote 2 or 3 years ago before I started taking the class, and my writing has just exponentially improved. I mean, it's such a valuable thing for me.
The woman who coordinates the MAPAC Writers Group has participated in a number of classes there, both as a student and a coordinator. Do you know Anne Grau?
I know her name. I think I'm connected to her on Facebook. But
And there are two other women who I've read with. One of them is in both the Yorktown poetry group that I'm the coordinator of, and the MAPAC group. Terry Dugan, Terry M. Dugan, and she's done a bunch there, and a very talented poet who I've read with a couple of places. M. Cifola has been there too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you've ever run across any of them in your classes.
No, I haven't. But the center, I could not recommend the center more strongly to anyone that is serious about writing poetry.
They have
classes in memoirs and fiction and lots of other genres, but my experience and focus has been poetry.
They've got classes in everything, in screenwriting, in memoir writing, in short stories, in publishing. They just do a terrific job.
It really changed my whole view and the whole way I write, and really has improved it.
Let me take you back to your writing. How about the end of the poem?
Sure. This poem is called Relapse to Instinct. Going out scares me. Even though I feel isolated and cut off from people, even strangers. People want too much. Listening to them and feigning interest in their whims bores me. Truth is, I don't care about them. It worries me, but I'm happy with it. I no longer have a parking permit, so I have to use a 5-hour meter and try to make my trips to the city like border raids. On the train, a woman with very long eyelashes is updating her fantasy football stats. If the guy on his phone says okay again, then I will have to kill him. He's a real estate broker or a lawyer and talks the entire trip with okay as his only punctuation mark. I don't like conductors and they don't get me. We are both on the same train, but for different reasons.
I like that. The other stuff that I'm familiar with of your writing, which obviously is the poems that you have and Live at the Freight House, is the Walt Whitman one and the political one about our present administration. Do you have either of those handy by any chance?
I can easily pull them up. The Walt Whitman poem I love. I mean, I guess you're not supposed to say you love one of your own poems, but I do.
Oh, you can. Sure. Sure you can.
It's called Drinking Alone. I walked into a bar and saw Walt Whitman sitting there, staring into his drink. He looked tired and past his prime. His once impressive beard now showed mottled gaps of skin. He started one of those bar conversations about sports and TV. After a few sentences, he said that he had been a poet, but that he hadn't written anything recently. I said that I was a poet who was still writing, and he said that he felt sorry for me. Walt said it was different when he was younger. He had freed American poets from their own vestigial limits. Other than editors, poets don't have any natural predators.
That's terrific. It reminds me of something that I did of a completely different vein. I quoted Judy Collins, that went right over my head. Joyce Carol Oates, another favorite. Of
that's
saying
not
that,
Judy Collins, for sure.
Right. As many people write poetry as read poetry, but then Billy Collins said, no, she's wrong. More people write poetry than read poetry. And certainly that was much of my experience.
I think that's absolutely true. I think there are a lot of closet poets in this country that would not admit to doing it.
And there would be more if so many people were not ruined in grammar school and in high school by the poetry that they were forced to read and to rhyme and to put up with, where it didn't make any sense to them. I know the fellow that coordinates the Mayor Pack writers group, Vinnie Dzhenko, Vinnie Dequino said that when he was teaching, he'd say, then now we're going to do poetry, and the ones in the class, oh, no,
but
you have to get by that,
And it's so wrong, because poetry, if anything, is really a lot of fun.
Yes.
I mean, I blame the nuns in my elementary school for any negative feelings I had about poetry when I was young.
Which elementary school was that?
St. Joseph's on East 87th Street in Manhattan.
Okay, I didn't know that one. I know that the close friend of mine lived right around the corner from Francis Xavier Parish on 90th. He was and I was there. His mother-in-law. But Lena Horn, and I was there for her funeral, and it was a very interesting church, Jesuit church. So, what's next for you?
I'm just writing my ass off and having a great time. I'm going up to Cape Cod in August to take a week long class with Nick Flynn, who's one of my probably the most favorite American poet.
That's great.
And I've come a long way in learning. I believe in my writing ability now, so I'm just having a blast.
What can you put your hands on? I don't have the title in front of me because I don't have the book in front of me of the political poem that you included.
I have one poem. I turned to a particular poem. It's called The Trump Tube. And I remember when I went up to Mayapak to meet with you to read that night, I didn't know what poems to bring because I didn't know what the audience would be like. But for some reason, I brought some political poems, and I don't write very many political poems. And they were very well received, so it was really nice. Anyway, this poem is called The Trump Tube. After narrowly avoiding civil war, elections were finally held for a new president. Then Donald Trump was placed in an iron lung for the safety of the nation. The new leaders thought that this was a just punishment because he couldn't play golf, grope women, or reach his own penis. the Trump tube would allow him to tweet with assistance, and it would force him to breathe while restricting all else.
My wife would definitely say that was fitting. She's one of the people that yells at the television screen when he's on. So
I basically stop watching television except for stuff that I download.
Well, I watch a lot of some of the people on MSNBC, and I'm also we've also been binge watching Longmire on Netflix. We've touched a whole bunch of bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Vincent Bell?
One of the things that I'm very interested in, and I haven't figured out how I'm going to translate that interest into action, is I'm interested in specifically from the point of view of a man, from a man's point of view. How can men have better times in their retirement? I mean, I was terrified of retiring because to me, what you did when you retired is you moved to Florida and waited to die. And so far, I think I've had a very exciting retirement. I'm doing lots of things. I work as a mentor at WCC and am very, very busy. But I think that within American culture, there are periods where men don't really have a clearly defined role or mission, especially as life evolves. And that's something that I'm very interested in, and I want to start to spend some time writing about it because I think men are critically important to our future and how relationships work out. They're very, very important in the development of their children. And I think a lot of men have just not stepped up to those roles. So that's,
one of the colleges,
that's my particular hobby horse. That's something I'm interested in.
One of the colleges that my wife teaches at is Westchester. I thought during my working life that I knew too many people who retired, hung around for a while, to go to Florida or do something else, and they died in a year or two. I once I got involved, and I still do it periodically, teaching at volunteer teaching at Marist College Center for Lifetime Studies, and it's amazing the number of retired people. There's a whole lot of people who are out of IBM to live in that area, and they come and take courses in the geology of the Hudson Valley or in managing a retirement portfolio or in gardening or in I've taught a creative disruption based on what we were talking about earlier before we went on the air about how technology changes everything around us that we don't even realize until we walk through a mall and it dawns on us that there are no more music stores because they've been eaten by iTunes and by MP3s or there are no more photography stores because they've been eaten by digital cameras the bookstores they aren't there anymore. So I've taught that, and I've taught the history of Google and the history of Apple, and people come from all over the place to participate here, and they teach their courses now at the Samuel F.B. Morse Mansion, which is on Route 9 in Poughkeepsie, and it's a funny thing because Morse, a lot of people don't realize, in addition to being the Morse code guy, was a virulent nativist and a strong anti-Catholic and anti-Semite. And Marist had its roots as a Catholic college. So that was pretty funny that it was being done there. But there was so much interest from seniors. There were 650 people in the program. They pay not much, and that entitles them. So I think it's either 2 to 4 courses per semester, 3 semesters. They don't do things during the snowbird season, and it's, and there's 700 people on the waiting list. You know, so it's just that there's a tremendous
old. If you could send me some information about that, I'd be very interested in that.
Okay,
I'm really enjoying what I'm doing at WCC too.
Older people that have interests that we never used to think about, when we used to see old people walking around on neighborhoods and sitting in the park and not apparently having any interest other than watching the boats go by, you know. So mm-hmm. It is very interesting. Would you read one more poem before I go off?
Yeah, sure. Just give me a second to find something.
Okay.
I don't think I read this before. It's called Lexington Avenue.
No, I haven't heard it before.
As we...
No.
Huh? You haven't heard it?
I haven't heard it before. Go ahead.
Okay. As we walked off lunch, crowds moved slowly through the city's din. We were talking loudly, not seeing the sidewalk people slowly dying in the bright sun. We easily turned away as we passed them, not missing a step. Throwaway people are acceptable collateral damage. Inconvenient, albeit. We just need to turn away.
And we do, and that's unfortunate. And in New York, when you see people on the sidewalk, either beggars or passed out, we assume that they're drunks or they're addicts, and they could have just had a heart attack, you know. And
I was saying to my wife the other day, if I ever have a heart attack while I'm walking around, I don't want to have it in New York City.
Yeah, I'm a big pet person. I have been for years. My dog and a couple of cats and the outside animals that we feed, but we also spend more money feeding our pets than we do taking care of people that don't have enough to eat, and that's really bothersome.
It's a huge problem. It's really a human tragedy, and in a way, it's part of, I think, one of the central corrosive problems we have in our society. It's just too much me.
Well, you know, we prove that, I think, with what's going on with the border, where we don't have all of the people, that there are less crimes from illegal immigrants or legal immigrants than there are from people that were born here and are citizens. And there's been very few crimes from these M13 people in comparison to the rest of the population. It's a big smokescreen. And we've always wanted to pull the ladder up. The pilgrims who got here wanted to pull the ladder up from the next bunch, and no one wanted the Irish, and the Irish didn't want the Italians, and the Italians didn't want the Hispanics. You would think after a while we'd figure it out that each one of these groups has made the country stronger and made the country, you know, but we don't follow history very well. I'm amazed that after the Soviet Union went down, and we seem to believe that all the Iron Curtain countries, they'd be going to democracy, and they'd be all wonderful people, the Romanians and Czechoslovakians, the Yugoslavians, and all of a sudden they started shooting each other because they hated each other for the 400 years, and it was the Iron Boot. And we should have realized that when we went into Iraq, and once we got rid of Saddam, that these other people who had hated each other for 1,000 years too, the Sunnis and the Shiites, were going to do the same goddamn thing. And we just don't seem to bring history to bear, and we keep repeating the same mistakes. You know?
And we conveniently forget that we're all immigrants.
Yeah.
I mean, my family's been here since the early part of the 19th century, but at some point they got off a boat at the tip of Manhattan and got whatever job they could get.
I had four grandparents born on the island, and they came during the 19th century, and just the courage that they must have had to get on those coffin ships, and to come over here and to build a life, you know, is great courage and great fighting odds. That I wonder whether the people that grew up here have the same spirit that the Mexicans coming here, who are willing to work in the fields that we're not. I know I'm certainly not, you know, and they seem to do things that the native people won't, and they make the country stronger. But you know,
I totally agree with you. I find the whole thing to be so distressing, but it is what it is. Yeah. So I don't know what the hell's going to happen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Vincent. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me on your show. I had a great time, and every time I get to talk with you, I learn more, I think, more than I teach you. So it's a net benefit for me, and I love the opportunity to read my poems.
Well, it goes two ways. So I hope that the audience will all be back next week for my interview with Giselle Houseman, and send any comments or questions to me on the show at johnmack13@gmail.com. In the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. And let's go off with the Eagles again. And Alexa, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Playing Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library.
My favorite group. Thank you again, Vincent, and good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Easy feeling. I know you all let me down.